Good morning, all. This is the not quite as bad time slot as being just after lunch. Instead, it gets to be just before lunch. So we'll try and keep it relatively short and lively, and I won't hold you up from lunch too much. I'm here to talk about the Connections Project and our history and use of open content licenses. We spent a fair amount of time at the IP roundtable, mostly talking about licenses for the source code, open source licenses. We got into content. I think that within the open source community, you know, we've had the license discussions. That's a fairly well understood problem for that community, that passing that knowledge on at the edges is always going to be an ongoing effort. But I think the content community is just starting to wrestle with the problem of how can we build communities that share content, and what are the kinds of licensing issues. It reminds me very much of the flame wars of you know, the GPL or not the GPL back in the 80s. So hopefully we can recapitulate without completely rerunning that history. And so this is an actual case study of what our actual experience has been. So just a little bit about the project itself, rather than our normal tech talk that, you know, all about the code. This started 3 years ago. We didn't go out with the goal of building some sort of content management system. The goal here was, you know, scratch your own itch. We had an electrical engineering professor, Rich Baranek, who had an advanced graduate digital signal processing course. And the curse of graduate courses is that there's always 100 textbooks for your class, but there isn't any textbook, right? In the fields that are interesting and on the edges of things, there'll be a number of books that cover mostly what you want to cover, but never one that covers it exactly what you want to cover, and never in the order that you want to cover it, or even with the emphasis that you want. So Rich said, you know, I'm just going to write my own textbook. And one of his friends is actually the dean of engineering, who's also kind of in the same subfield. And being a dean, and having the wisdom of that position, said, been there, done that. You don't want to do that, Rich. You don't have 3 years to waste. That's basically what it takes to get a textbook written and through the publication process. And especially in what's supposed to be a hot field, you're then just grossly out of date. You've written the 101st textbook now. So Rich knew some of us were interested in doing the open source stuff, and he asked us one time over beer, can't we do this with content? Can't I just write the parts that I'm interested in and get, you know, Doug at University of Illinois, who's much better than I am at his specialization, get him to write that section? And we said that sounded great. Yeah, let's do it. In fact, one of his grad students at the time has since taken a degree and stayed on to be the technical lead on this project, Brent Hendricks. So we early on sat down and thought about what is our goal here and what are our values for this project. Because what we wanted to avoid doing is, since we are techies, it's very common for people to build techies to get lost in building the tools and committing the field of dreams fallacy. You know, if we build it, people will just come and use it, right? So our goal really is collaborative creation of open content for education. And if we build the tools for that, that's great. If we can find other people's tools to do that, that's equally good. We have been doing this for over 3 years now. It's currently in use to teach courses at Rice, University of Illinois, Ohio State. We have a course being built now at Cambridge, so we're international. And as I said, our core values here are about building communities who then can build the content and do it in an open fashion. So our buzzwords are about it being a new approach to the three aspects of this: are authoring the materials, gathering together in order to teach, and the people receiving the materials, the learners, the students. Some of the key aspects are we're building a commons of materials. We used to call it the repository. We're borrowing some language from Creative Commons people. Make sure it's open and free. Modularity is key because we're interested in this reuse, right? We want to be able to use Doug's material from University of Illinois to teach my course at Rice and not have to rework it, right? So what are the technological fixes for that? We need collaborative authoring. And we're not going to try and impose this from the top down. We have all suffered through excessively early standardization sometimes, where standards get built around an idea instead of the actual real-world experience of implementing something. Decided to that in order to keep scaling here, we can't just be another publishing project where everything has to get reviewed ahead of time. You know, the lesson from the scientific journals is that the big cost in publishing peer-reviewed materials is the review, managing the review process. And that's some of what there are content management systems that help automate that and reduce those costs, but that's still the choke point. So there we're hoping that we're taking a lesson from the theoretical physics crowd where they do essentially post-publication peer review. Things go up and then get commented on. And from the third facet, the third direction from the learners, one of the educational goals for this is to try and increase the connectivity of the curriculum by having materials that are usable both across universities but also within the university, within a particular curriculum, across departments, you know, physics and electrical engineering, you know, closely related things, but also more broadly related. We know of a professor who, after hearing one of our talks, said, you know, I need something like this because I teach architecture and I need access to materials about macromolecular structures because I have this idea about how, you know, protein and DNA molecule structures relate to how people like to build buildings. And there is no resource for that right now. And clearly that's a completely different contextualization of the materials about protein structure. So we want to build a system that allows that sort of thing. And students, so that's different contextualizations for the instructors, different contextualizations for the students. Often students will get to their senior year or when they come back a year after having had a real job, they will finally come to you and say, oh, now I understand why we had to learn calculus before we could learn this, or now I understand why we need this, and I'm really glad I have my course notes from that, or I wish I had my course notes. So we're trying to hopefully push the aha experience earlier into the coursework. But this talk is not about our system and its goals, except for the big goal is trying to build knowledge communities or knowledge commons. And my thesis is that this requires three sets of commonalities. You need common cultural vision, goals, and norms, kind of basic community stuff. You need a common technological framework, and you need a common intellectual property framework. In our explicit case, the common cultural standards, norms, and goals, we're borrowing those from the existing intellectual and academic communities. You know, we're not trying to build a novel community around a novel idea here. We're just trying to build a way to express those ideas differently. And there's lots of people who will talk about those things and do research on them. My co-author on this paper, actually, that's his field of study. He's actually an anthropologist, Chris Kelty. But it's beyond the scope for today. Common technology. What have we learned from that? Well, standards. Although not standards. Not too many standards. As we've heard from Paul Everett's been quoted a couple times today about making yet another standard is a sign of weakness. There are plenty of them out there to use, and we try to live by that. We have written a few of our own, but in the last year, we've actually been reducing the number of custom standards we use. As I think what's basically happened, what I like to think is what's happened is that we had a vision that was a little bit beyond where practice was, and practice has caught up with us. And as that happens, we are fairly egoless about using our own stuff. We'll throw it away and use more standard stuff. Now, it's not that we're so great about being egoless. It's that we don't have the resources to maintain and advance all of these custom standards. You know, we spend too much time already trying to get more resources, so we want to work on the stuff that's actually novel and different. So, but we do need certain capabilities. Electrical engineering materials, we need to be able to put math on the web in the right way. Therefore, we adopted MathML branch of Mozilla back, you know, over 3 years ago. That meant it was, you know, three guys who had an interesting side branch on MozDev. It was not the mainstream browser. But that one paid off. You know, MathML support moved into the mainstream. It moved into the branch that that became Netscape 6. So we now have math support in the mainstream browsers. And someone else came out of the blue and wrote a plugin for IE, so we didn't have to. We love that sort of thing. Transparency. It's not build the tools and they will come. People come to these things because they want the content. They're not really excited about the tools. and we need to enable reuse and sharing as much as possible. As I said, modularity is important for that. Learning how to write in a way that's sufficiently modular and able to be reused or recontextualized, we're finding, is not clear. People are very used and trained to writing a single linear stream of thought to teach a particular class or to get across a particular idea. I think we're finding that the level of granularity differs with the field. The technical fields tend to chunk up pretty nicely. We're finding out if music does. We have a professor working on music this summer. And we have a few people in humanities with other things who may need bigger chunks. We'll see. Semantic markup, regardless of what John Noodle said, we strongly believe the presentation versus content versus meaning division is important for this stuff, mainly because of the future-proofing of the content. It allows use of the materials in context that were not envisioned by the original authors. Although I agree with him that you have to sneak in getting the semantic markup, disguising it as if it were presentation markup. That's how we've gotten, we wrote our own little ConnexML, and one of the big wins for some people who already had books, basically, written in LaTeX. They said, I've got this wonderful, beautiful book. I give it to my students every year, and they always complain that there's no index. And I don't want to do an index because it's a pain. It takes a lot of effort to go in and build the index at the end. So when we got his material converted into ConnexML, he uses term tags instead of, bold tags to mark terms and definitions. And we punch the button, and boom, there's an index. And he said, this is great. This alone was worth the effort of converting the materials. So we got to find for each author what the payoff is going to be. So we got an index for him, and that gave us the ability to, just this year, we're auto-generating glossaries off collections of modules. And that wasn't an initial goal, but we can do it now. Metadata is very important for all of that, of course. To do this kind of sharing and collaboration, of course, you're going to need linking capabilities, both within the repository, within this commons, and to external sources. And you got to manage the content. So we came in through the back door, worrying about building a specific content, and now we've realized that, we're building yet another content management system. Let's throw that away and use one that's already there. We're in that process right now. I got to put up the pretty picture because basically the idea here is that there's lots of raw knowledge. Our author community uses this magic gold box of authoring tools to put their particular spin on it and chunk up, generate these things we call modules because we haven't come up with a better name for them. We spent too much time trying to call them other things. For us, a module is not, at MIT, I believe it's like an entire course, right? And it's not a typical educational module that covers a long period of time. For us, a module is as small as self-contained a topic as you can get. In the engineering domain, a typical hour and a half lecture will be anywhere from 5 to 10 modules. So it's only maybe half a page in a textbook. Maybe as much as 2 or 3. Another tool, the next community, are the instructors, who often are also authors. There's a lot of overlap. And they use this magic robot there to select things out of the repository and build these linear strings of courses. And there's some nonlinearity as well. And the last tool here is the roadmap tool for our students, that they can navigate along these courses and not get lost. They can keep track of where they are, but still guided navigation so that they can wander among the content and not be buried by it. Okay, now the point of talking about intellectual property here. In order to be able to reuse the materials, why are we worried about openness? Well, module reuse, we think, requires a license that allows derivation. Even the best written materials are not going to be completely portable from one context to another. If the context is as broad as moving from teaching students what protein structures actually look like and how they function as an enzyme to comparing them to the Guggenheim, there's going to have to be some restructuring of the information. And that's derivation, not modification, which is one of my points later. The continuous improvement to generate high-quality content by incremental modification requires actual modification. If you keep making another derivative, you end up with an excessive proliferation of models that are very, very similar. And why does this have to be a common intellectual property framework? As was said yesterday, They weren't going to be licensed Nazis. We are. Because mismatched expectations will cause legal problems. If everyone's all nice and happy up front when you're just starting a project out, but once there's some investment into it, in personal time and attention, and I think that point is very, very important, then you have butting heads and conflict, and we want to avoid that as much as possible. So fortunately, somebody else did some of our work for us again. The Creative Commons came about, and we're an early adopter of their licenses. In fact, I think if you go to their database, we still have more pieces of content in their system than anybody. We're not really the target market they were thinking about when they started creating the Commons. My understanding is that they were thinking more about music and more traditional non-textual medias, but they did a good job of making it sufficiently general and repurposable, and so we've been using their materials there. Most everyone around here knows about Creative Commons. So just one quick page for those who didn't. Their goal are to create common legal vocabulary to minimize all of this wrangling, hopefully learn some of the lessons from open source and bring them on, and to recreate some sort of a public domain. There's a strong feeling among certain parts of the legal community that we've lost the public domain, and we have to use modern licensing approaches to recreate something like that, a commons that we can share. The important pieces of the licenses for us is that authors retain their copyrights. The licenses are then licensed to other people to reuse, and with the modular approach on the licenses of attribution, commercial use, derivation or modification, and the copyleft or share and share alike clause. We don't, in our existing repository, we don't allow all variations on the license. We actually use what we consider the freest of them, which is the required attribution only. More details, of course, at creativecommons.org. So, what have we learned in these 3 years of building a system? We've got, by the way, about 1,200 modules right now, teaching a dozen courses at these five universities. Got to deal with IP up front. Make it part of the initial system design. Don't run and hide from it because it will find you and catch up with you. Get everyone to sign off up front on the IP design. That means your designers, the coders, most importantly the authors, any administrative authorities who are involved, because often, which is a point I'll get to a bit later, there's a distinction between who actually has the legal rights and who is attributed as an author. Everyone has their own, usually wrong, ideas about how IP works. This is true in every field I've been involved with. There's a common fallacy among biologists, for example, that there's an exclusion for pure academic research to the patent laws, that you can use patented technologies freely as long as you're doing government-funded peer research. It doesn't exist. This one might be a bit controversial among a bunch of technologists, but I don't think there are technologies to solve IP problems. IP problems are problems that are social in nature, and they have to be solved by social means. However, every time technology advances, it impacts the class of social problems. In the days when it took several years of work by a monk to copy a book, there was no copyright law because there didn't need to be. It was just too difficult to do. And as the printing press came about and the copy machine, there have been advances and changes in this trade-off between the common good and rights for the authors. Lastly, don't embed IP policy in the technology, but build the technology to enable various IP policies. Just because you're using open source materials or open source tools or open content licenses doesn't mean you don't have to deal with control ACLs and such. So specific lessons. The case of the missing metadata for authors, owners, and maintainers. Oh my. This one bit us early on. We came to realize that the author of a work often is not actually the copyright holder in the academic setting, and actually even more strongly in the industrial setting. One of these things, authorship, is about attribution, who gets credit for having written the work. The other is about legal rights, you know, the copyright holder's unique rights to limit and allow other people to use the work. And even beyond that, we have the problem of delegation. In academia, we don't actually manage to convince very many professors to write XML. They have their students do it. That doesn't mean that the students are now the authors, although in some cases that is true. It means that they have delegated the problem of maintaining the content. Now, if you build a system that does not allow that to happen technologically, they'll do it anyway. They'll share passwords. And so you don't want that to happen. You want to be able to keep track of who actually did what. So we split out the difference of legal rights versus the technical permissions by actually tracking three different groups of legal persons involved with each legal work: the authors, the rights holders, and the maintainers. Our typical example there is, you know, if we put Macbeth into our system, clearly Shakespeare is the rights holder, is the author of that. He's not going to be logging into our system. He does not need an account to do the markup. So we need separate maintainers than that. And of course, in that case, the rights holders it's in the public domain. Lesson two, teach your authors well. Because, as I said, they will have misconceptions about what is the reality of the IP in this case. And they will come to the people in charge of the content system and ask them. So first off, learn and then teach. What are some of the things you have to teach? Here's one that we screwed up: modifiability versus derivation of works. We were all excited telling people about how important it was going to be that these materials were under open licenses that allow free derivation so that we could have this, you know, increase in interaction and reuse and improved quality. And what everyone kept hearing is, I'm going to put my stuff up there and everyone else gets to edit it. Don't want that to happen. Well, that isn't what happens. What happens is that they can make a derived copy, which then their name is attached to, and they can modify. If they want to work with you on your copy, they have to work with you. Another lesson is that copyright isn't about... It's sort of the flip side of the same lesson earlier. Copyright on a work is not about credit. It's about money, basically. It's about controlling what can be done with the materials, and usually in exchange for money. Credit is attribution, and that's mostly what academics are worried about. And if you ask them bluntly, they will realize that very few of them are going to make very much money off their educational materials. There are a few people who write star textbooks and make a lot of money, but if you ask them how big their last royalty check was from their last textbook, they will talk about the few pennies that they get per year. So they're then much more willing to put materials into a free system where other people can use them. In fact, we expected to get more pushback on that than we actually have. Mostly the pushback on that is coming from the administrative level. And the faculty have actually been thankful to have external support to say, give an example of something of why they want to maintain the copyrights themselves so that they can give things away when dealing with their own administrations. They can point to our project and say, look, we want to be able to participate in that. And I strongly feel there are no technical fixes for plagiarism. However, that doesn't mean we ignore the possibility of plagiarism and make it really easy to occur on our site. You can't just go in and change the author on a particular page. Which leads to trust but verify. We decided to get around part of the problem of people claiming that they have the rights to existing materials by not taking existing materials initially. We're writing up all new materials in a new flavor of markup. In reality, that means we're using existing materials that hadn't been published anywhere else, that we were able to verify that they really did own them. Another aspect of that is make the IP decisions that a user is making as a user system very clear. This is both for their state of mind and also for your legal protection. Click-through license agreements, as we heard earlier in this meeting, have been supported in court a number of times. We use one as a generic one to have the authors agree to the policies of our particular repository when they first get an account. But we also cause them to select the license that they're going to use with every new work. Now, right now, there's one option. But we have put the hooks in place to allow multiple kinds of licenses. This is another case of where we simplified the initial implementation, because dealing with collected works that contain materials with different licenses on them, you run into the problems of license clash. And freedom does have a cost. As I said, just because you're using open licenses doesn't mean you just get to use a wiki for everything, and there's no controls at all. You still have to implement the access controls. You're going to use them for workflow, you know, production of modules, delegation. Work groups are a particular implementation of that. Unpublished modules, authors, even if they intend to make something open, often don't want to work in the fishbowl and put their initial sketchy notes up. Not everyone's Dave Weiner. And, as I said, open licenses can interact badly. We learned this over and over in the open source world about dealing with licenses that may or may not be GPL compatible. So you need controls to help the user not make mistakes. Other prices of freedom, maybe the flip side of the coin. If we have a large amount of material that's been licensed for free use, we don't want to go put it into a system which is then going to tag it all up and not make it freely usable. I've gotten PDFs that remark that you can't print them and you can't, you're not supposed to do spoken performance of them, of Alice in Wonderland. You know, that's in the public domain. So if you're using something other than a content management system that knows about the possibility of having free licenses, then you're in trouble. I've seen a number of the commercial ones presume that you're going to want extreme tight control, and it's hard to turn all the controls off. So where do we go from here? Well, this is going to be interesting as we build this commons that's less about trying to exchange content for money as it is about managing reputation. So by making all the IP issues clear up front, we're hoping to minimize the amount of using weapons, licenses as weapons of mass bombardment. We had a case, actually, where while we were dealing with the lawyers and getting our licenses in a row, we needed to get content in the system, and so we had informal agreements with some faculty. And once we had decided on a license to use, we went around asking people to officially sign off on, yes, I will release all the existing stuff under that license. And we didn't hear back from this one guy. Okay, well, there were a couple of people we hadn't, so we make the appropriate contacts and try and get an answer, and finally end up cornering him and discover that he hasn't been really happy with the quality of the work that's going in and hadn't talked to us about it, but absolutely refused to put the open license on it. So we had to pull content. That's something we wanted to avoid. We do have the hooks in place because there will be, I'm sure, in the future cases where we trusted but didn't verify sufficiently, and there will be content that is not legal for us to republish, and we'll be able to pull it out. So that was actually a reputation issue. He was not happy with his name being associated with the content as it was. We didn't have the option at that point of scrubbing it and taking his name off of it. And that's actually an interesting point of international law. I'm not sure you can even do that in Europe. There's something about the moral rights of authorship that you can't give away. And I think that means you may not be able to, I don't know, talk to a lawyer. Lenses and filtering and faceting, apparently, is the latest buzzword of maybe fits better what I've been trying to think about. Only in the last year or so has our system got large enough that we have enough content that we have to worry about more advanced systems of searching. This is one case where we didn't want to build the tools for something that didn't exist yet. So we're in the process now of taking a look at systems people have and seeing how to use them, because we want to avoid the idea of filtering. We wanted to make it clear that all of this work exists and that you're not getting rid of some of it, but you're just focusing on a particular aspect of it. That was our thought about lenses, but I think I like the idea of facets as well as a phrase to describe that. If there are any questions, we can discuss our experience with IP issues. I could do a little demo if people want. We've got a few minutes left, or we can break for lunch. Microphone. We'll move on to the instruction part, the discussion part, and do the microphones. It's on the bottom, I believe.
Testing?
Again.
You haven't spoken at all about the peer review system. Could you tell us a little bit about that, if that's been implemented or what your plans are?
Honestly, it hasn't. It's primarily working at this point by... as I said, we like to use tools that exist rather than building our own just for the sake of having one. Therefore... we've been building parts of work groups that are necessary for the content management system, but not implementing channels of communication. I guess this actually relates to something I was talking about with Paul Everett earlier. It's hard to get people interested in content who have content to use your tools, right? They have tools already, and they will come to you maybe interested in using your system, but then immediately ask if they can use what they're already used to using to put stuff in. And so... there's really no point in us coming up with a system to review and discuss modules if we've already got a peer group who's working together to build this content and they communicate fine via an email list. Now we're adding links and hooks, and we have actually been discussing with some of the other projects out there who are rating content. Technologically, we're looking at putting... I don't have it here to demonstrate, but... we're using annotations as a means of marking up, putting additional commentary on pages, and then folding that in for review. Further question?
Who gets to participate in this system? Is it strictly for professional academics? If so, how are they chosen, or on what basis are people brought into this? Is it open to amateur researchers?
Our intent, there are two sides to the project, of course. There's building the tools, and there's having an instance of that set of tools. And our project is both. And your question applies to the second, right? Clearly, the tools are such that they're all GPL'd and can be used by anyone to build such a tools, to build such a repository of however they want. Our specific repository at Rice is, in fact, intended to be open to all. Right now, you get an account by sending an email to a particular address and asking for one. We don't require academic credentials as such. You have to be willing to use Emacs to write XML, which has been the biggest hurdle at this point. We're working on adapting some of the existing... this is one of the areas where we thought other people will get that done for us by the time we need it. Maybe a commercial editor, maybe an open source editor. It hasn't quite happened, so we're now putting some resources into seeing which of the open source editors we can help extend. So that's a policy issue rather than a tool issue. Our policy is that anyone can, and we haven't had to turn anyone away yet. Questions? Switch at the bottom.
Is this better?
Yeah, it's better.
Okay. This high-tech stuff is too much. I have a couple of questions. First of all, how about the students? Is there a facility by which students can comment on a particular module?
Right now, that is an email link at the bottom. The version of our roadmap that we're... right now, we don't authenticate students in any way. Students can just access the system. And therefore, they haven't required logins onto the system. We've been wrestling with the idea of anonymous commentary, if we're going to allow comments to be posted onto them without a login. I think the lesson from much of the web is that the barrier of having to put some sort of name on it and have actually logged in a little bit will improve the quality of the commentary. So we're implementing student logins for this fall. We have the annotation system completed using the Annotea W3C standard. We implemented our own server for that because the W3C one was a little crafty and a little difficult to keep running, so we wrote a Zope product to do it. And so this fall we'll be testing that out. In fact, in our user tests with our students who have used this, and we've now have had 3 years of courses that have been taught with this, and particularly sequences of courses within electrical engineering, we've picked up the first engineering year student courses, the 200 level courses, and then the 300 level courses, and the students gave us the feedback that they really appreciated being able to link the materials forward, but they wanted the ability to discuss the materials at the site. So we're looking at annotations and shared annotations. They all want an IRC chat. And so, as I said, we'll use existing tools and drop them in.
Yeah.
Just tip it in.
Now it's working. Having students be able to make comments that are seen by other students, mm-hmm. as well as seen by whoever developed the particular mm-hmm. module is really, really very useful.
Is that your experience from the Harvey project?
At the Harvey project, we've actually implemented something so that we have a discussion group, mm-hmm. Threaded discussion, associated with every module or mm-hmm. unit of our content, and that's worked fairly well. The other question I had is, to what extent do you support the creators of these modules? Obviously, you tell them, okay, we have to have certain standards, you have to agree to this license, you have to have mm-hmm. XML metadata, but do you help them build the content? Do you provide guidelines for pedagogy or technology?
During this initial, we still consider this a startup phase, but we're getting late startup now. What we've been doing is taking some of our resources, and actually the significant chunk of the resources, and paying Rice undergrads to do markup for particular faculty. We have a lab dedicated to connections that this summer is very full of students. We find we get a lot more work out of students during the summer than during the school year. The support at that level is the faculty can provide some form of content which then gets converted and marked up. We're moving away from that model because it's very expensive. And in fact, we have I'm involved with a NSF grant for a bioinformatics course where we're providing, in fact, let me log in here and demonstrate our
That was my next question. You said you threatened to give us a demonstration. That would be great.
It's a slight bit of a cheat. Given the problems we had with network earlier in the week, I figured it'd probably be solved by now, but instead of going to our live machine, we're serving up that laptop. Let's see. Which of my myriad of passwords is this one? Okay. We currently have logins implemented specifically for authors and instructors. Our organizing principle is ad hoc work groups. We've had some experience with that now and have decided that we're going to also implement a generic workspace so that every user just has a default workspace so that things can happen fairly automatically, certain aspects of things. Here's my specific work group that I'm the only member of, and there's one useless module in there. So let's go back to my collection of work groups. We'll ignore that for now. We'll actually go back, and I will file a bug report with Brent. Let's see. I know what's happening here. Brent has updated the Zope product for our work groups, and on that system, they haven't gotten upgraded. I'm going to go ahead and do the... Let's go ahead and make a new work group. That was the best way to... The demo demons attack. Let me do a quick fix of pointing at the live system. Now we'll wait for Zope to restart because it won't redo a DNS query. Mozilla. Let me describe what will happen. Here we go. Our organizing idea for author support is ad hoc work groups, where anyone with an account on the system can create a work group, and anyone who's in a work group can then add other people to the work group. We don't have particular roles within work groups. So we have not implemented a workflow system because we figured that by the time we need one, we'll go use a different one. Because we have not implemented a course management system because that's not what this is about. This is about collaborative building of content. You can spend a lot of time re-implementing Blackboard. So let's log into our live server. Much better. So you can see I have a different list of work groups here. This in particular is our collection of people who are working on a NSF grant for a bioinformatics course. There are currently no modules within this work group, but we've got a generic repository of files. We've made it easy to use your existing communications tool. So just creating a work group essentially creates an email list. We're currently not archiving those emails. We have the tools in place to do that as soon as the new servers get here, so we won't run out of disk space. We're turning that on. Now, there was a little bit of a communication snafu on this particular one, and two different work groups got created. So this work group actually has modules in it. And each of these modules, so this is basically the level of our content management system. It allows upload and download of individual pieces. Communications via email. And we have various tools and pieces we can drop in, but haven't done that yet. We do actually have a grad student in psychology who has a small grant to work with our project. On she works with a professor who does usability studies, user interface issues. And it's been very interesting to have her go through our materials and discover just how poor engineers are at building interfaces for general students. Yes, other questions?
Could you talk some about the financing of the whole enterprise, especially from the point of view of it looks like if this were really to take off, publishers would lose. Is it grant funded?
So far we have a grant from the Hewlett Foundation. Our initial startup funds came from angel investors, you might say, although they weren't really investors. It's early on, Rich Baranek, who's the faculty lead on this project, I had the clever idea to give a presentation about it at a very early stage to the Rice board when they were there for the annual meeting. And several of the board members got very excited about it and sufficiently excited to actually write personal checks. So that gave us a little bit of freedom on the initial startup. One of those gentlemen likes to describe himself as a venture philanthropist. He's given us some money and also given us a lot of advice on how to manage a startup project, basically, a startup company. There are some things that are different because it's not really a company. You know, it's more about building academic communities than it is about return to investors, but we're actively pursuing other grants. The long-term plan actually is to build down our central requirements for materials. We'll end up being mostly a tools project and have things like this NSF grant. There are a fair number of grants out there actually for doing curriculum redesign and new courses and such, which fit in very naturally with this.
What about maintenance?
Maintenance at what level? The tools or the
I suppose both the tools and, mm-hmm. and the sites and access to them and updates, I suppose. of the modules?
Well, that's the long-term goal there, is to model some of the open source continuing projects. We've talked about spinning off from Rice. In fact, we have buy-in from the very beginning that this was not going to be a Rice thing. It's bonded tightly to Rice. Once we've demonstrated that you can build a reasonable repository with these sorts of things, we're looking at spinning off the tool set as a .org of some sort, modeled on like the Apache Foundation or that sort of thing.
And what about connections to academic tenure decisions, those sorts of...
This is one of the reasons we have a staff anthropologist on board. actually, there has been a lot of discussion about that outside of our project. In the last couple of years, there's been a lot more advance in that than you might think, often not in the technological department so much. Across campus, over the humanities side of things, there are some departments that are very open to the materials not being, how many published books do you have on the shelf, but actually being utilization of materials. We do, keep all of our logs, and we can provide feedback about how many courses, particular modules are getting used in, what universities are teaching courses using your materials. That's the part of the reputation management we were discussing about. Mike.
Along that line, if you have this data, can you give us some numbers about actual reuse of the content?
Well,
those are very scarce numbers to find. That would be very interesting.
There's scarce numbers to find. We only have, I like to say we have over 1,000 modules, but our modules are pretty small, so we only have about 1,000 modules. All the caveats first. The bulk of our initial content came in from existing course materials, textbook materials that authors had who were willing to put into the system, which means that our materials are fairly stringy. They tend to have long, we do these plots and put them on our wall to remind ourselves that part of the idea is to get this interconnectivity. And actually, Brent may know off the top of his head better than I. I know that it's not such an exciting number that we publish it up front right away. Within electrical engineering and the curriculum redesign that department has committed to, we have been getting good reuse between courses that are related, which, believe it or not, is a significant progress. I've been told that it's not uncommon for courses that are in the curriculum that are supposed to follow each other and depend upon each other. Often the faculty who teach those courses will only talk about what they're going to teach in the course every 3 years or so, when there's the grand meeting of the faculty to make sure the curriculum works. So I don't have a quantitative number to tell you how many of those are actually reused per course, but it has been happening. I think it's mainly it's a bootstrapping issue. You've got to have materials in place before you can reuse it. And you have to learn how to write materials so they can be reused.
I'm going to
diverge.
Since I happen to be holding the damn thing. Could you tell us what media are supported by the tools? So far, I can imagine that text is one of them, and mathematics is another. I'm curious about what other media.
Basically, ConnectML acts as a wrapper. It's our kind of document language. We have a media tag that lets you put anything you can do on the web, you can do in a ConnectML module. So that's the short and simple answer. We prefer to use open tools as much as possible. To date, most of our materials have been very textbook, very textual. This summer, we have this music course that is being put in place. Is there actually a published course for it? No. Pull this one up. That's going to be a significant number of Java applets, actually, in that particular one. We're actually working with, in the specific domain of electrical engineering again, we're working with National Instruments has a tool for doing electrical modeling sorts of things, and they're interested in having a student who they'll pay for work on building a web version of that can plug into our modules. One of the great things about the math approach here is that by using the standard, MathML, we're able to generate math that is not only scalable and looks really nice on the web, but the tools have caught up that you can cut and paste math out of our modules into Mathematica and then solve equations and play with them. Now, other areas haven't got that far ahead. There are a couple of music markups that aren't very good. So we're stuck at Java applets at this point for that. David Lane, our psychology professor, has some interesting course materials that are going in the summer that are not so linear. But they're linear, but he's got three tracks. Every single topic section he has, he writes three different versions. One sort of an outline, one a more traditional textbooky thing, and one he calls the multimedia version. And we're putting all of those into the system right now and providing linkages between them. And we'll be tracking how different students, now that we're going to have students logging in, we'll be able to track which students are using which traces of the modules and feed that back to the professor so that he can then correlate that with how he perceives they're doing in the course. And maybe that's part of the curriculum redesign that we're looking at is, Rich likes to talk about closing the feedback loop. He's an electrical engineer.
Maybe we'll get to put your presentation here into your system and have it be an example of really great multimedia video and audio live at Harvard.
I should give that a shot.
Okay, thank you, Ross, very much.
Thank you. Yeah, we're into lunch time.